Tonight I'm going to talk about the Buddha as a revolutionary rebel. 2600 years ago, when the Buddha lived, India had this very strict philosophical system that historians called Brahmanism, and it's a forerunner of today's Hinduism. And a typical feature of this was the caste system, which still exists in India. The caste one was born into was what determined one's purpose in life and one's duties. And it was impossible to change that destiny. So in short, it was a very typical class society where higher castes had a lot of advantages. Life was predetermined depending on which caste you were born into, and this was considered something that the gods or higher powers had decided in the beginning of time. And the life of women in this caste society was even more circumvented by rules. A woman was never allowed to decide over her own life. As a child, her father decided everything. And as a married woman, her husband decided. She was supposed to obey her husband. And when she was old, her sons was the ones that decided. And you could marry someone from another caste either. So against this background, the Buddha's teaching appeared to be extremely radical. One of the cornerstones of the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching, is that there are no gods or higher powers that rule our lives. We shape our lives ourselves by all our actions and what decisions we make, what choices we make. That creates the circumstances of our life, and this is called karma or kamma in Pali. We create kamma by our own actions. The Buddha explained that what determines whether an act is moral or immoral is the purpose, the intention behind the action. It has nothing to do with duty or caste. One does not become a Brahmin or a slave through birth, but through one's actions, he said. And by this utterance, he invalidated the whole religious foundation that held up the social structure of his contemporary society. Accordingly, the Buddha abolished the caste system in his Sangha, his followers, his assembly of monks and nuns. It was a classless collective where Brahmins and sweepers and queens and prostitutes had the same value and the same rules to live by. So the predominant view of women in Brahmanism was that women were a sort of lower standing beings and that they couldn't get enlightened without first being reborn as men. And the Buddha said that women had the same ability to get enlightened as men. When women could become nuns and study the Dhamma, which was difficult, of course, it gave them freedom from forced marriages and early childbirth and gave them the opportunity to be enlightened like the monks had. So the enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha tell their stories in a book which is part of the Pali Canon it's called Terigata, the Songs of the Elder Nuns. And it's really interesting to read. There is a contemporary book by a woman called Susan. Oh no, I forgot it. It's called the Early Buddhist Women, anyway. And many of these nuns had been married off by their parents at a young age. And some of them had had very difficult marriages, or they had become widows because of war or accidents. Their husband had died. And widows in India had very low status, and they couldn't marry again. And they often have had great difficulty in supporting themselves. So if they didn't have a family that would take care of them, they had to live in special widow houses and only wear white clothes and no jewelry for the rest of their lives. So some of those women became nuns, and they were former dancers, also musicians and prostitutes, women who had escaped from rich men's harems. But there were also very high-ranking women who voluntarily left their privileged lives to join the Sangha. The Sangha means the assembly, the followers of the Buddha. For example, the Buddha's own stepmother, Queen Payapati, she was one of the first nuns. In the Sigaluvada Sutta, which is a discourse by the Buddha, which contains advice for householders like us lay people, he says that women should be respected, well treated, and given all the responsibility within the home. And of course, this was mostly a traditional female role, but it was still a big step from being treated as an inferior kind of being without any power to decide anything about their own life. So Buddha actually talked both about the class struggle and early feminism, which was extremely radical at this time. But in about the 9th century, the Buddha lived about 500 years before Christ. But then in the 9th century after Christ, both the monks and the nuns' order disappeared because of war. And because of the war, there was drought and famine and difficult times on Sri Lanka. And in India, the Buddha's teaching almost disappeared completely during the Mongolian invasions. For a time, most of northern India was ruled by these Muslim invaders. And the monks' order was restored in Sri Lanka after about a generation, and because they could invite monks from Thailand. Buddhism had by this time also spread to Thailand, and so they could invite monks that there are certain requirements. A monk has to have been monk for at least 10 years, and certain other requirements to be able to ordain new monks. But there were such monks in Thailand that met those requirements, so they could ordain new monks, and the monks' order started again. But the nuns' order was never restored. So since then there are no real nuns in the Theravada school of Buddhism. And if you have been traveling in Thailand or Burma and those countries, you see a lot of sort of nuns. they are dressed in white or in Burma in pink clothes. But they are not real nuns, they're not bhikkhunis. The name of a monk is bhikkhu, and a real nun is a bhikkhuni. And those white clad and pink ones, they only have 8 or 10 rules, which is the same as lay people have when they go to retreats, and I was talking about that yesterday. So ordained nuns have 311 rules, so that's the difference. But now there are a lot of attempts to revive the fourfold assembly, which is what the Buddha actually instituted. He even said with that some figure that asked Buddha if he wasn't now he was enlightened and everything was and he was getting a bit old, and he asked if he wasn't going to die soon or leave parinirvana, to leave this earth. And he said, no, I can't do that until I have established the fourfold assembly, which is monks, nuns, laymen and lay women. And now there is only a threefold assembly because the nuns are missing. But in Sri Lanka, they are trying to revive the fully ordained bhikkhunis. And in Sri Lanka, they have managed to do that. There are already more than 1,000 nuns there. But in Thailand, and there's the resistance from the patriarchal Sangha council, these old monks, they don't want the nuns order to be revived. And it's the same in Burma and Laos and Cambodia, that the monks Sangha stick to this view that the nuns Sangha cannot be revived. But many ordinations still take place in Sri Lanka and also in America and Australia. So, despite this eradication of Buddhism in India, even there it has started to revive now in the 20th century. So even today this revolutionary message of the Buddha remains in India through a man called Dr. Ambedkar. And Dr. Bhimrao Ambedkar, he was an Indian politician and a very prominent figure when India became free from the British. And he started this social and political movement of the Dalits, which is what the very low caste and poor people in India call themselves. And Ambedkar was low caste himself, but he was lucky and had a teacher in his, he met somebody that realized that this was a really intelligent kid that should, given the, and he was given the opportunity to study first in Bombay and then later both in New York and London. So in 1923, Ambedkar returned to India, where he founded an organization to try to abolish the caste system. And he was also the one who formulated the constitution when India became free from the British and they gained independence in 1948. But it was very difficult to implement these reforms, and even if the caste system was officially abolished, it stubbornly lived on in the population. They were so brainwashed with this system that they couldn't intermarry between the castes and all this, the class system. So Ambedkar had studied Buddhism for many years, And he realized that the best way to free the low castes from the caste system was to convert from Hinduism to Buddhism. So soon before he died, Ambedkar converted to Buddhism, and he urged his followers to do the same. Big groups among the Dalits did this too, and especially in the state of Maharashtra, which is the state where Mumbai, it's called now. There are many, many Ambedkar Buddhists there, millions. And they even have monasteries with monks and nuns and so on. And the funny thing is that even outside of India and Hungary, Ambedkar's Buddhism has started. Hungarian gypsies, they drew parallels between their own situation and the Dalits, the low caste system in India. So inspired by this, they started a movement which they call the Jai Bhim Network. And Ambedkar's first name is Bhim Rao, so Jai Bhim means hooray. Hooray, Bhim, something like that. And they also started to convert to Buddhism. So the Buddha actually also talked about solidarity and generosity, ethics and meditation. That is dana, sila and bhavana, which is opposites to greed, hatred and ignorance. And one aspect of Buddhist ethics is right livelihood. It's one of the steps on the Eightfold Path. And that means that you should earn your living in an ethical way, having a job that doesn't hurt other creatures. For example, dealing with weapons or drugs or win benefits on to the expense of others, and contributing to the suffering in the world. That's the wrong way to earn your livelihood. And even animals are entitled to a decent life. And one should show kindness and concern about them as well, according to the Buddha. And a completely different area where the Buddha was also a revolutionary predecessor is the environmental protection. The basic idea of Buddhism is that everything is interconnected and everything depends on everything else for its existence. So nature, animals, plants, and human beings are part of the same cycle. And then it goes without saying that one shouldn't destroy or pollute the environment, the nature. So in Vinaya, which is another book in Pali Canon that contains the rules for monasteries, for monks and nuns, there are rules about not contaminating the water, the soil or the grass. And there are instructions to build hygienic toilets and so on. And in the time of the Buddha, they didn't have all these chemicals and air pollutants that we have today. But he introduced rules for the kind of contaminants that they had. Spitting, urine, poo and other waste was not allowed to throw it in the water be careless about things like that. And in Buddhism, there is a reverent attitude toward trees, especially all the big trees. They're called vanaspati in the Pali language, and that means the fathers of the forest. And the Bodhi tree, where the Buddha sat and got enlightened and meditated, that's of course the most noble tree. But all sorts of trees are worthy of respect and gratitude, for they give so many gifts to us. They give shade. If you're on the road and there's a big tree, you can stop in the shade and cool off for a while and rest. And they give fruits and seeds, leaves and wood, so on. So many of these most significant events in the Buddha's life took place under trees. He was born under a tree and enlightened under a tree, and he died under in a grove of trees. And all these events in the Buddha's life happened on the full moons of May. Of course, different full moons, but and this month, the month of May, is called Vesak in Pali. And so if you come across that sometime, the Vesak ceremony is the celebration of the full moon in May, and that's the most important Buddhist celebration in remembrance of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and final Nibbana. So the Buddha always urged his disciples to go out into nature and sit under the trees, by the roots of trees, and to meditate there. So, during the night when the prince Siddhartha, the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha before he became enlightened, he sat under the Bodhi tree, Mara, this mythological figure, which is a trickster, sort of someone that always tried to disturb the Buddha or make trouble in all different ways. And so he came to him when he sat under the tree and tried to make him doubt his ability and his right to sit there with this high aspiration, sort of, who do you think you are sitting here and thinking you're going to become a Buddha? Ooh. And then Siddhartha touched the earth with his right hand, calling the earth goddess Maidarani as his witness that he was in his full right to sit there. And this gesture, this mudra, you can see on many Buddha statues. If you see, there's many statues that have one hand in the lap and the other one touching the earth. So, and that means this, that it means actually that the teaching of the Buddha, the Dhamma, is anchored here on the earth. Unlike many other religions, they turn usually to celestial gods in the heaven or other sort of divine beings, and they treat the earth as unholy and secondary, something for us humans to own and exploit. But this the Sigalovada Sutta that I mentioned before about women, it also says that a housekeeper should accumulate wealth in the same way as a bee collects pollen. The bee doesn't harm the scent, the leaves, or the beauty of the flower, but it collects nectar which it turns into honey, while at the same time pollinating the flowers. So similarly, we should work in society, not harming nature or other beings in our search for wealth, and to use our wealth for the best of the planet and all other beings. So Dhamma is actually very much in line with today's environmental movements, which wants to introduce the rights of nature, laws that makes it a criminal offense to destroy nature and the ecosystems. So just as people have rights, you know, they are these human rights, the United Nations have this, and nature should also have nature's rights. So then politicians, CEOs and others in leading positions could be held responsible for causing ecocide, meaning the destruction of nature and its ecosystem, just as it is illegal to cause homicide or genocide, that means killing one person or groups of people. So that is something that would be a way of stopping all this exploitation of nature, destruction of nature. And recently, actually, the government of India has decided to give the holy rivers Ganga, Ganges, and Yamuna and their ecosystems legal rights. And the Whanganui River in New Zealand has also been guaranteed legal rights following a legal process that's been going on for 100 years between the state and the Maori, the Maori people, the indigenous people of New Zealand. And the river is sacred to the Maori people, and they want to stop the industrial pollution that's going on. And they finally, after 100 years, they won this legal process, and the Whanganui River became protected. So we human beings are totally dependent on nature. Everything comes from nature. Everything we eat, all the materials we use. There's nothing that doesn't come from nature, actually. So if we continue to destroy and pollute Mother Earth and her atmosphere that protects us, the climate will deteriorate, which is all it's already doing. And it may ultimately be a real catastrophic situation of extreme weather conditions and famine and mass death of species. Maybe even the end of mankind's short guest appearance on Earth. And this reminded me of a poem that I read by a Swedish poet called Sten Selander. And he seemed to have been quite a bit ahead of his time, because this poem was written already in the 1940s. And it's about that we humans haven't managed to destroy all the beautiful and fragile things in nature. The trees and the seasons will live on whether we are here or not. So the poem is called The Treetops. And I have actually translated it from Swedish. So actually it's rhymed, you know, but it's difficult to fix the rhyme in English, so now it's not so. But anyway, I made my best try to translate it, to get the message through. So, the treetops. We have smeared everything and stained everything on this earth that we have raped 1,000 times. But something is still here that our itchy craving could not reach. In the treetops hovers a world untouched and worthy to long for. There plays a wind, there sings a thrush of everything you cannot hold or catch. There a down soft bird's nest swings in the winged peace, the only peace, as torches the flames of autumn leaves burn, of icy fire from the frontier of destruction. And the frost carves its crystal dream far beyond the fall of man. There blooms in the sun, there sparkles of ice in the uninhabited paradise. So from this perspective I talked about, we can see that the Buddha had both revolutionary and sane views on many social issues which are still current today. Class, society, equality and feminism and the environment was on the agenda already 2,600 years ago. But unlike our politicians and companies who only look at things based on constant growth, money and profit, the Buddha saw these problems from two aspects, both the practical and the spiritual aspect. So by creating rules for people's physical behavior and by teaching how to develop spiritually through knowledge, contemplation and meditation, he created a system that could work. But unfortunately, this spiritual aspect is almost completely missing in today's political and communal debate. So, equally necessary as introducing laws against ecocide is to teach people to change their minds. Western civilization is characterized by a view of nature as merely a resource of raw materials for man to own and exploit. Nature and animals and plants have long been regarded as a kind of instinctive machines without consciousness or emotions, which is mainly a view that originates from this philosopher Descartes, who lived in the 17th century, the guy who said, "I think, therefore I am." So he thought thinking was the most important thing, which as a Buddhist, you know that thinking is a lot of not things that aren't true or fantasies or repetitions and everything like that. It's not before, because we think that we exist. Anyway, even modern scientists have come to the conclusion that animals and plants are complicated, conscious and sensible creatures. And indigenous people that live close to nature, they have of course known this for a long time, but nobody wanted to listen to that. So even trees communicate with each other and take care of their children, their small trees, and they can send nutrition to trees that don't feel well, and so on. You can read about this in a newly published book by a guy called Peter Wolleben, and the title of this book is The Secret Life of Trees. So we human beings must realize that we are also nature. We are made up of the same materials as animals and plants. We are not outside or possessing a nature. We are part of it. So we must interact with the ecosystems and the sensitive and complex communication and dependencies system that has been built up for thousands of years. And now clear cutting a forest can destroy this very complicated sensitive systems in just one day. Big machines come and just flatten everything. So we must once again become the children of Mother Earth and integrate in this large universal family of species and stop imagining that we are set to rule, control, and own and consume them. So as I said, the traditional way, Buddhist way of looking at the world is that it's an interrelated entity where everything depends on everything else. And we can see that in our own bodies and minds when we meditate and we practice this introspection. And we can gain these insights in this flow of change, death and renewal, which is going on all the time in nature and in us. And we can also come to understand there's not even a governing, controlling entity within ourselves. No constant I or eternal soul. Everything is this multifaceted process in mind and body that affect and interact with everything else. So different external and internal circumstances constantly affect our actions, and we adapt ourselves in the way that seems best at the time. But we still believe that we are the ones who controls and decides over our lives. And we do that to some extent. We can choose what we want to eat for lunch, or what clothes we want to put on, or what movie we want to see, or even what retreat we want to come to. But we have no control over the actual major events of life. We can't decide if we're going to get sick or not. We can't decide if we're going to get old and die. We don't know when we're going to die. It's totally not something that we have no control over. And in this we are the same as all other animals on the surface of this earth. But we humans, with our big minds, we have the ability to worry about the future, to imagine coming catastrophes. So this climate anxiety is a new kind of psychological sickness that people suffer from when they hear about all these bad things that are going on with the environment and climate of the earth. And this is what psychiatrists say, that many people have this, what they call the climate anxiety sickness. So I will end with a poem again, which talks about this. But it still has some kind of optimistic tone. It wasn't the treetops is a pretty depressing but beautiful poem, I think. But this one is a little bit more optimistic. And if you don't know what a wood drake is, it's a wood drake in this poem. And I didn't know what it was either, but I looked it up. And it's a bird. It's a very beautiful and colorful kind of duck that they have in North America and Canada. So this poem is called The Peace of Wild Things. And it's by a very famous poet called Wendell Berry. When despair of the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things, who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world, and I am free. So let's sit for a moment and take these words in. And this time I finished on time, exactly 8:30.